Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on list.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
One thing that is nice about taking a few days off and coming back on a Thursday is that tomorrow is already Friday, and that means it's a Reardon Roundtable. Jane Duker will be here, former Speaker of the Missouri House, Tim Jones, and John Gaskin, all on the panel. Also, actress, comedian Christine Bianco. She's very, very funny. And she's at the Gaslight Theater this weekend. She'll join us in the 3 o'clock hour. Every time I wake up in the morning, or, you know, I'm kind of checking the news at night in particular, I do kind of tune out at night a little bit. I wake up, you know, this morning's a good example. Obviously, the snow is on the minds of many of us here, try to figure out what's going on. But then I see this devastating coverage from California. And CBS News correspondent Steve Futterman is with us this afternoon with an update. Steve, how are you?
Doing fine. We're having a strange convergence of two tragic stories today, Mark. Right now, I'm actually in Westlake Village, California, which is right next to Thousand Oaks. They are having the memorial service for the officer who charged in during that nightclub massacre just a week ago. I mean, that story seems so long ago. Since that time, we've had the fire here. One woman came here today. Her daughter was injured, not seriously, but injured during the massacre. She came here to salute the officer. She said her house also burned down. I mean, it's just the stories that have been happening here the last week are just remarkable.
That is just amazing when you think about it. So how many fires are going on right now?
We have two major ones. We have the Camp Fire, which is just that tragic fire north of Sacramento, where now the death toll there is 56. It will go up tonight, I'm sure. It goes up every evening when they make the announcements. More than 8,000 residences have been destroyed. A town of around 25,000 people, ironically named Paradise, is essentially destroyed. Some of the schools have been destroyed, some hospitals, the city hall. That's a cliche when you cover a major fire. The town has been destroyed. It never is destroyed. Paradise comes pretty close to it.
Yeah, so Steve, you've covered, and we've talked about these, you've covered a fair amount of wildfires, California, Colorado, Arizona over the years. How does this one compare with the amount of devastation?
Well, the amount of devastation is there's nothing that compares to it. The way the fire spread, these fires, you talk to firefighters, they will say fires have personalities. The personalities of these major fires the last 3 years, whether it was up in near Napa, Santa Rosa, here, these fires are much more aggressive. They spread much more. They spread more rapidly. They catch people off guard. These are different kinds of fires than we've seen before. Now, is it because of climate change? Well, you know, I don't want to say climate change exists. Some people think it does. Some people think it doesn't. Something has changed that has affected the way these fires burn.
Now, you mentioned the campfire, but the other fires that are going on right now are the ones near or a lot closer to Los Angeles, correct?
Yeah, the Woolsey fire, that fire is more than 50% contained. To me, that fire is pretty much in the control of the firefighters right now. The winds have died down. They're really moving in. The firefighters became aggressive today without the winds. We'll have a report later tonight. I would not be surprised if the containment number jumps to over 60 tonight. But that fire, I think, is, unless some surprise happens, that fire is on its way out. The worst is over there. And I think the worst is over even with the campfire. When we get these numbers of new numbers of structures destroyed and people dying, these have already happened. It's just that we're getting more accurate numbers than we've had before. They haven't had time to check every square inch, every square foot of property in Paradise to see how many structures have been destroyed. So when you see the numbers go up, it doesn't mean that, 1,000 more burned today.
But they're counting them. Burned. Yeah. Well, so then on the number of people, because I saw one figure that said up to 300 people are missing. How is, you know, I hope that that's not how many people were killed by this thing.
Well, it's now down to 130. We've had this before where a lot of people are in a panic, and understandably so. I can't find my friend. I can't find my relative. I can't find my neighbor. They call the police. The police put this person down as missing when that person actually isn't missing. So, but we understand that happens, and that's why that number comes down. Now, this death toll number, which is now 56, and you have 130 still unaccounted for, the death toll is going to go up, and I would not be surprised if it goes up significantly. But it's not going to be, I hope not, but I'm pretty sure it's not going to be all 130.
One of the things I heard, Steve, this morning, and I just want, this is important, I think, for people listening right now, maybe you have Thanksgiving plans or something like that. I heard a report that some people were canceling travel plans because they were worried about the fires. But, you know, the landscape is very large out there in California. And while there are fires close to Los Angeles and north of Sacramento, for the most part, there are fire-free areas in California, right?
Yes. Yeah. 99.9% of California is fire-free right now. This is only a small portion of Los Angeles, Los Angeles County. If you go up to Santa Barbara, if you ever go from LA to Santa Barbara, these are the cities you might hit. Calabasas, Agoura Hills, Thousand Oaks, Malibu. These are the areas that were hit by the fire. But even those small cities, they are not completely destroyed. It's just pockets that have had serious damage. So, yes, you can come out here and have a wonderful Thanksgiving next week. I'm sure the LA tourist agency will be very happy that I tell you that.
I'm just amazed when I see the video of some of these people in their cars just barely making it out, you know, before they're fried, and the horrors of not only, I mean, it's one thing to lose all of your possessions, but to lose everything around you as well, you know, like entire communities. That's, we've seen it here, obviously, with tornadoes, but this seems to be a lot broader, wider devastation.
Yeah, this Paradise Fire did fit that description that you gave. And like I said, I've never seen that before. I've seen fires with lots of damage, but never so inclusive of basically everything in a city. Just remarkable.
All right, Steve. Well, we'll let you get back to it. I know that this is just one of those terrible stories that occasionally you have to cover. And you got a couple of them this week with the shooting from last week as well.
Yeah, it's amazing that these two stories next door, basically they were both in Thousand Oaks at some point. That's where the shooting took place. That's where the fire initially began. And back-to-back days, just remarkable.
We'll go out with your theme music. How's that sound?
Yeah, Blink 182.
There you go. Steve Futterman, CBS News correspondent. Thank you, Steve.
Take care.
The big story is a big deal. Keeping you informed. News Radio 1120 KMOX.
All right, welcome back. You know, I was off for a few days. There's a couple of pieces of business I want to catch up on, and I have not been able to weigh in on the former Navy SEAL who is the newly elected congressman from Texas, Dan Crenshaw, and what happened on SNL the other night, because it's rare that you have something that gets executed as expertly as that whole moment with the apology and sort of flipping this back on Pete Davidson. And I like the way it went down. So we'll talk about that here in our next segment. We have an audio cut of the day coming up as well. We have a Reardon Roundtable tomorrow. One of the veteran Roundtable panelists is with me in the studio this afternoon. I can't say former yet, but soon to be former. See how we just kick out the door, Scott? Soon to be former state alderman, or I'm sorry, St. Louis alderman, Scott Ogilvie,
God,
how are you?
It kind of hurts to hear that.
Yeah, well, I know, right? So what's the,
what have I done?
Let's cover that. First of all, you are still on the board, but you decided to not run for re-election.
I did. I think the very short version is, I think if you're going to be in an election, a campaign, you got to be feeling 100% committed to doing the campaign. And it was getting to the season where I was going to be campaigning, and I just wasn't feeling 100% committed to doing it. So I thought that was an indication that I should you know, look for another spot and give other people who were interested in running some time to figure that out and not, you know, wait till the last minute to announce.
How many years on the board overall?
It'll be 8. It's kind of flown
by. Run.
It's been very interesting. It's been the best job I've ever had, for sure. And I, you know, a lot of things that were priorities for me, I think I was able to get done in those 8 years. So overall, I feel very content with the time spent at City Hall.
Well, we've known each other for a while, and one of the reasons I appreciate having you on the show, and look, I sincerely say this because I think we don't agree on a lot of things. We come from different places politically, but I think, and you know, other people on the roundtable panel have said the same thing about you, whether they said it to you in person or, you know, to me behind the scenes, because I like the approach you take. You think about these issues. You don't come down just based on whatever ideology you're supposed to have. And I think you've been a good representative. So I don't like to say nice things about people very often, Scott, but I'm saying a nice thing about you. And
somebody,
I really mean it. I really
record
mean
that so I can play it back later.
No, yeah. I think you've done a great job. And I think that your leadership and your perspective in particular is going to be missed. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on. So in the middle of the, the recovering from the midterm election, I saw you tweet this out last week. And the headline was, the nonprofit paradox, 40% of real estate in St. Louis is government-owned or tax-exempt. That seems like a pretty fair amount, 40% of the real estate.
Yeah, it's a big number. I it's hard to figure out exactly what that percentage is in every city, but without a doubt, St. Louis has one of the smallest geographic areas that is subject to property tax in the country of any city. And that happens slowly over time. There's a bunch of factors there. We have a big park system. We have lots of government-owned property, whether that's the federal government or the Zoo Museum District, or just LRA properties, parcels that are, you know, have gone tax delinquent and the city owns. But a growing percentage of that is nonprofit institutions, which is now nonprofits own slightly more than 10% of all the acreage within the city, which is a big chunk. And nonprofits,
including hospitals, big hospitals,
right? Universities, and you know everything down to you know the food bank, all the above. So obviously, people know that nonprofits are exempt from a lot of taxes. They're exempt from federal income tax, but they're also exempt from a lot of local and state taxes. And in Missouri, we have a very favorable environment for nonprofits, so they're exempt from property taxes. They're also exempt from paying sales and use taxes, or from collecting sales tax from their own retail sales, which is not very common nationally.
Yeah, I don't think I knew that.
And they're also exempted from the city's payroll tax. So you add up all those lost streams of revenue to the city.
I don't know if you've done a calculation just on the earnings tax in particular. Is there a figure that would jump out?
Well, they pay the earnings tax because the earnings tax is paid by the employee. So like an employee of BJC,
they have
instance,
it pulled out of their paycheck.
They are, right, yes, right. They are paying their earnings tax. But there's also a 0.5% payroll tax that companies pay in the city. That's just 0.5% of their payroll. And nonprofits don't pay that. Now, I don't have, and you can't really get the exact payroll figures for all the nonprofits. However, if you make some informed guesses based on the number of employees in the city overall, what our payroll receipts are, the number of employees that nonprofits employ, that figure is probably between like the high $3 to $5 million. And then the sales tax gets you into maybe 15 or 20 million sales and use tax that's not collected. And the property tax then is over 30 million. And most of that would go to the school district. So
would you deem some of these folks, I'll just use the word, freeloaders?
No, what I'm really trying to point out is the structural problem we have in the city. So these nonprofits, you know, they provide a service and they're just following the law. These are the laws of Missouri. They're not doing anything wrong. And I don't think they're particularly trying to take advantage of the situation. But when you have a city that is separated from the county, it's only 62 square miles, and the city has a very disproportionate amount of the region's institutions that are nonprofits. So universities, hospitals in particular, but also, you know, centers of government, federal government buildings, all this stuff takes up a lot more space proportionally in the city than it does anywhere else in the region. So just a lot more of the city's property is off the tax rolls. And we don't have, you know, if you were to, for instance, combine the city and the county into one big jurisdiction, that 25 square miles that is off the tax rolls, that's not a big percentage of the region's area. But as
for
we
the
said
city,
earlier, it's 40% of the city's area, so it's a big deal.
What do you think should, when I saw the headline, just read the piece, that was a little alarming to me because I didn't know that the percentage was that high. But explain for people listening right now why. I mean, there's been a city that is cash strapped. This is rather relevant, right? And this is why this is important.
Yeah. So there's two approaches. the first approach is what Boston did. So Boston's had what's called a PILOTS, which stands for Payments in Lieu of Taxes program.
I've heard of these, yes.
That is, they started in the 70s, but they ramped it up substantially during the last recession. And Boston's situation is comparable to ours, but even more extreme. They're only like 48 square miles, and in close to half of their property was off the tax rolls, mostly through nonprofits, you know, hospitals, institutions, et cetera.
Yes.
So they negotiated very carefully with all of the medium to large nonprofit institutions in Boston and got them to commit to pay a percentage of what their property tax assessment would
be. And that's the PILOT, the payment
exactly,
in lieu of taxes.
The PILOT. So they started that in 2008. They've slowly, they didn't go from, you know, zero to 100 right away. They phased it in over several years. And so they're up to, I think, about $40 million a year now that those institutions pay, which is still, it's probably still less than 10%.
But how are they able to do that and get an agreement? Because that you're going to have, obviously, if you try to do something like that here, you'd have a fair amount of pushback. And this is not actually necessarily anything new. People have mentioned potentially dipping into that as a revenue stream in the future as well. But it's not easy to negotiate, is it?
It's not. And I think Boston had to make the argument that, you know, similar argument that I'm making, that, look, you guys are located here. There's a cost to supporting these institutions that the city incurs. You have to have police and fire protection. And you got to pave the streets and you got to have a sewer system and you got to have streetlights and all this stuff that local taxes go to pay for. And it you can't really run a city properly when half the city is not paying taxes, right? So I think the institutions in Boston said, all right, we do have some responsibility to pay to kind of cover some of the costs that the city incurs because we're here. And in Boston too, the benefits that these institutions provide, they're not just benefits to the city of Boston or the city of St. Louis, they're benefits to the whole Boston region. But the city of Boston or the city of St. Louis is the one incurring the costs associated with them. So the institutions in Boston said, sure, we have some responsibility here, and they started paying. So we could look at that as an approach. I think that would take some pretty heavy political lifting, but I don't think it is out of the question that over time you could get some type of agreement that provided some extra revenue. I think the bigger fix is to do the restructuring thing where the city and county are just in one taxing district, and this becomes much less of a problem.
That's a little controversial.
It is a little controversial,
that one,
and that's out of the scope of, you know, what the city can do on its own. But I think,
look, that, you know, and I would admit that's the fix for the long term, and it probably at some point certainly something needs to change. But I'm also a realist when it comes to those things, and I don't know that we're heading in that direction. We talked about Mayor Slay said 8 years ago that was one of his goals when he ran for re-election the second to last time, and it's a tough pill to swallow. And seemingly now there aren't even really people. I know there's some stuff happening behind the scenes talking about it. When it comes to this issue, Alderman Scott Ogilvie with me though, this seemingly should be an issue that not only a guy on the radio and Scott Ogilvie should be talking about. Do you sense that the mayor's office and that other people are looking at these issues? I know that there's been some discussion in the past, but is it a priority?
I don't know that this is a particular priority, but I think it is a growing concern. And I think there is a growing awareness both at City Hall and I think just among the public that this is a problem. Not, you know, nonprofits and in particular big institutions used to be a much smaller percentage of the country's workforce. Hospitals and universities have grown a ton. You know, every year they account for a bigger and bigger share of the economy. And when those institutions are primarily in cities, they're even a, you know, much bigger, you know, the eds and meds economy of cities, they're a much bigger proportion of our local economy than they are the national economy. So this is something that I think a lot of cities are grappling with to some extent. And there is, I think there's certainly room for improvement in St. Louis that doesn't, you know, unduly, let's say, punish these nonprofit
institutions. It just sounds like one of those issues, again, we're seeing this with roads in Missouri, that it is important, it should get some attention, there should be some planning, but I just have this feeling like it's just going to get kicked down the road, you know, kicked down for someone else to deal with, and then it never gets dealt with.
Maybe. You know, there was an effort that kind of stalled out a few years ago to levy the payroll tax, which is, I should say, most of these policies are state policies. They're really out of control of, you know, local lawmakers. We can't do anything about, you know, the sales tax exemption. We could levy the payroll tax. So there was a bill introduced a few years ago to levy the payroll tax on nonprofits.
Now, what does that mean exactly?
That's that to charge them that 0.5% payroll tax that all regular companies are paying.
That they're exempt from at this point.
The nonprofits,
and you could do that with just passing a bill?
Just passing a board bill. That's a local law. Yep. That bill didn't.
Well, why wouldn't you guys do that? You love to pass taxes along with people. Come
taxes,
on.
Yes. Well, there was. I think it was. I don't think the sort of behind the scenes conversations had happened.
Yeah.
Sufficiently to get people on board to make that. To get that to pass. So there was opposition to it. But it was kind of, I would say, an opening salvo that got some people's attention. And I could imagine it being revisited at some point in the future. So, you know, that's maybe the first thing we could do that is at least within our power locally. But I do think it's wise to sort of get buy-in from especially the larger institutions before.
Yeah, I think you'd have
you
to. Right,
things.
Right. Yeah. Hopefully some of those discussions are taking place. Alderman Scott Ogilvie, when does the term come to an end?
My term will be up at the end of April.
Yeah. So not until the end of April, there's declared folks in your district at
well,
this
filing
point?
Opens on November 26th.
Are you tossing your endorsement behind someone?
I may. Yeah, okay. I may do that if I think
if the right person
exactly
is there,
yeah. Or if maybe the wrong person is on the other side.
Well, there is that too. Well, thanks again for coming in. I'm sure we'll have some conversations leading into 2019 before you leave the board, and obviously get you back on the Reardon Roundtable as well. You wrote this piece, though. Is it Next STL is where it's posted?
Next STL, yes. Invite everybody. They do some great coverage of local development and policy issues. So I'd invite everybody to check them out.
Awesome. Thanks, Scott. Good to see you.
Thank you, Mark.
Scott Ogilvie with us this afternoon on KMOX.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
329. All right, I got a bunch of things to roll through here before we get to audio cut of the day. A reminder that tomorrow is Friday, ladies and gentlemen. Seems like it came on us real fast. Oh, yeah, it's right. I didn't work the rest of the week. That's why. I don't shake your head in there, Klein. I enjoyed my time off after, you know, sacrificing my body in the woods of Howard County in order to put meat in my freezer on Saturday. Successfully, I should say. I bring that up for this reason, ladies and gentlemen. Nice segue to Chemung Township, New Jersey. Or is it Chemung? A woman was arrested after police found, I'm not making this up, and I apologize for those of you who might not like this topic, but it's a true story. It's not fake news, apparently. A woman arrested after police found 44 dogs dead in her home freezers and more than 100 more living in filth. Donna Roberts is her name. She's a fine-looking woman, if you see the mugshot. 65 years old. She faces charges for keeping the animals in, quote, deplorable and inhumane conditions inside her Chemung Township, New Jersey home. Health department officials called to inspect her house, observed animal cruelty inflicted upon various breeds. I mean, it's really disgusting. You got 44 dogs dead in plastic bags, 130 living in squalor. How does that happen without anybody realizing that it happens? So I just thought that was a weird story, and I'm not real happy that I had to do that one, but I just came across it when I was going through everything else. I'll lighten it up with this then. You know, I'm just going to throw a hodgepodge together. Mike Leach, we like him. He's the head football coach of Washington State. He's quite a character. And he was asked in his postgame, or one of his, I guess it wasn't postgame, but his weekly news conferences, the important question, why does Goofy stand on two legs, but Pluto is always on four? That's actually really good when you think about it, right?
Yeah, that's a good question. I thought about that when I was a kid. When I was a little kid, I used to think about that. So yeah, you have dogs and ducks and mice, and all of a sudden they need a dog. And so you, and they make him the regular dog. That's the biggest stretch in logic, and one of the biggest stretches in logic in cartoon history, I think, is Pluto. Pluto is truly an aberration, because Pluto's supposed to be a dog for a dog.
Yeah, I'm a bit, you know, I wasn't really troubled by that until now. And now I'm troubled by it. All right, a couple other stories. I opened the show with this, but I think it's worth passing along because you will not hear this anywhere else. Scientists acknowledge key errors in study of how fast the oceans are warming. A major study claimed the oceans were warming much faster than previously thought, but researchers now say they can't necessarily make that claim. Oh, Reardon, that's a fake news account that you're just spreading out there because
you are fake
news. You
don't
like all this stuff about climate change, right? That's the Washington Post. It is Chris Mooney and Brady Dennis, the Washington Post. Scientists behind a major study that claimed the Earth's oceans are warming faster than previously thought now say their work contained inadvertent errors that made their conclusions seem more certain than they actually are. Oh, that's weird. Imagine that happening, ladies and gentlemen. 2 weeks after the high-profile study, wait a second. I thought this was settled science. I thought that if you had a researcher that submitted his or her research for publication in an esteemed academic journal in this country, that is damned settled science. There's no wiggle room here for mistakes that were made or for, you know, completely manufactured studies that are delivered by the way, when that happened, and I'm referring to this group of professors who were liberal professors who submitted all the fake studies, and were like 18 fake studies to academic journals, and 8 of them actually took the bait on just ridiculous things. That's settled science, of course. So 2 weeks after this high-profile study was published in the journal Nature, its authors have submitted corrections. The Scripps Institution of Oceanography, home to several of the researchers involved, also noted the problems in the scientists' work and corrected a news release on its website. They had previously asserted that the study detailed how the Earth's oceans have absorbed 60% more heat than previously thought. Ralph Keeling, who is the climate scientist at Scripps, who was the co-author, says, well, we made some mistakes here. I think the main lesson is that you work as fast as you can to fix mistakes when you find them. I think the main lesson is don't make mistakes when it comes to this important issue so you don't scare the hell out of people, because that's what you did here. And thank God the Washington Post, which I guarantee you put this on the front page, as did the New York Times and the other publications, probably our own local paper. You think they'll have this correction in there or not? Now, this was a couple of days ago, and I was off for a couple of days, so I don't know if anyone else has addressed this, but I did think it was important. The other thing that I haven't addressed is Pete Davidson and Dan Crenshaw. And I like the way that this guy, this former Navy SEAL, he's now a Republican congressman-elect from Texas, handled this in the first place. So Pete Davidson, Ariana Grande's former fiancé, was on SNL last week doing this.
This guy's kind of cool, Dan Crenshaw.
Oh, come on, man.
Yo,
hold on.
You may be surprised to hear he's a congressional candidate from Texas and not a hitman in a porno movie. I'm sorry, I know he lost his eye in war or whatever.
I mean, it's ridiculously embarrassing, and SNL does not rush to any kind of apology last week. You know, Dan Crenshaw says, I don't want it. It's not going to matter anyway. Now, I think both sides did the right thing here. They invited Dan Crenshaw to come on the show. Now, he originally said, this is not the best. It's Veterans Day weekend. He has events with veterans planned. He said, is there another weekend? Well, this is a very timely thing. And SNL said, no, it's Veterans Day. It's the right time to send the message. So at the end of Pete Davidson's segment on SNL on Saturday night, and I apologize, I know a lot of you have seen this, but since I was off, I wanted to pop off on this a little bit. Here's what it sounded like.
For people that don't know,
The reason you're wearing an eye patch right now is that you lost your eye to an IED in Afghanistan during your third combat tour. And I'm sorry.
Thank you, Pete. I appreciate you saying that.
So we good?
We're good. Apology accepted. Just keep breathing.
So what's happening there is Dan Crenshaw's phone is going off with the ringtone there, and he reaches into his pocket for the phone. That is, well, that sounds like Pete Davidson's former fiance, doesn't it?
You're gonna answer that?
No, and I'm just gonna let it ring because that's rude to answer. Let's just let it go to voicemail.
No, it's cool. Ariana Grande. Well, I'm cool, man. Yeah.
But, oh, do you know her?
All right.
Now that was funny. I'm guessing Pete Davidson was in on the joke, but maybe not. I mean, that might have actually been one where they set him up and they just kind of caught him off guard. And then Crenshaw said this.
Last week, I made a joke about.
I think I messed up. I think I played those in reverse. So it was first where he did the apology, and I think that pretty much covers it. But let me go to what he wrote. This was also in the Washington Post. Dan Crenshaw wrote this piece post-SNL. He goes, the past couple of weeks have been unusual for me, to say the least. After a year of hard campaigning for Congress in Texas and gradually entering the public sphere, I was hit by a sudden blinding spotlight. I have no complaints. It wasn't as bad as some other challenges I faced, like a sudden blinding IED explosion. See what I did there? Saturday Night Live has created a comedic monster, he said. On November 3rd, he talked about Pete Davidson mocking his appearance, and he said people thought some lines should not be crossed. I agreed, but I also could not help but note this was another chapter in a phenomenon that has taken complete control of the national discourse, outrage culture. And let me bring this up from a different perspective. And I don't know, Dave, you'll have to tell me if this story went anywhere. So I didn't, during my days off, go on to Twitter very often or follow the news because, you know, I'm taking a little vacation time. But there was Sports Illustrated did the Women of the Year and the Men of the Year, and then they put women in quotes with Serena Williams. And that became this big outrage a couple of mornings ago on Twitter. Well, the deal was is because this artist that she's worked with always puts his deals in quotes, and it was because of, there was a reason for it. And I don't have all the, didn't anticipate talking about this, so I don't have all the details, and I apologize. But the bottom line was you had the outrage culture. I swear to God, I think that, you know, unfortunately, I think my kids are in this right now. They wait for things to come up on Twitter or in the news, and it certainly isn't something that's going to make them outraged, like somebody who lost his eye during his third tour of Afghanistan, who went back there after losing his eye, mocking him on Saturday Night Live. That's not outrageous. You didn't see any of these kids, the millennials, the folks on Twitter, the Hollywood types, get outraged by that at all. But when women was in quotes because there was a reason for it to be, and everyone thought that was misogynistic, and it was somehow, speaking of that, I heard Nancy Pelosi today say that the men that are opposing her in Congress, the Democrat men, are misogynistic, or potentially. It's ridiculous. So this outrage culture exists, and Dan Crenshaw is right. You know, we're just some people out there, I'm not in this group, I think many of you are not in this group, you just want to be finding, you have to find that next thing that's going to really outrage you. And he said, anyone who doesn't show the expected level of outrage will be labeled a coward or an apologist for bad behavior. I get the feeling that regular, hardworking, generally unoffended Americans sigh with exhaustion daily. I'd like to think that they do. I really would. So he wrote in this piece, he said, I didn't demand an apology. I didn't call for anyone to be fired. That doesn't mean the war or whatever line was acceptable, because it wasn't, by the way. And I didn't have to fan the flames of outrage either. And he talks about how SNL reached out, and he says he was happy with the way it worked out. But he also admitted this. He goes, does it suddenly mean that the left and right will get along and live in utopian harmony? Maybe Saturday's show has made a tiny step in that direction, but I'm not naive. As a country, we'll have a lot of work to do. We need to agree on some basic rules for civil discourse. There are many ideas that we will never agree on. The left and right always have different ways of approaching governance based on contrasting philosophies. But many of the ultimate goals, economic prosperity, better health care, education, are the same. We just don't share the same vision of how to achieve them. And, you know, I think that he goes into some things here that are pretty worthwhile. And we're all, well, look, I've been guilty of this in the past. Ideas, he argued, are fair game. So if you think someone's idea is awful, say it. But there's a difference between, this is very important, this is why I wanted to do this afternoon. There's a difference between attacking an idea and attacking the person behind that idea. Labeling someone as an ist who believes in an ism because of the person's policy preference is just a shortcut to playground-style name-calling cloaked in political terminology. And unfortunately, we have a guy in the White House that sort of leads the way on that, but that's another issue. Crenshaw said it's generally a good indication that the attacker doesn't have a solid argument and needs a way to end debate before it's even begun. And he's right about that. So I like the way that whole thing went down. Rarely do you have both sides kind of coming together, maybe making people laugh a little bit, still focus on what happened, and not having everyone just have to be offended. But just wait, there'll be something else tomorrow.
It's Mark Reardon now. Total Information PM starts at 4 with news, weather, traffic, and information you need on KMOX.
Well, you know, I took a few days off and catching up on some stories. This one came out yesterday. I still think it's amazing that there's a follow-up today. The story about the homeless vet spending his last $20 paying for gas in Philadelphia to help a New Jersey woman. It was all fake, and that was a story that was told that inspired a big GoFundMe campaign. And this is the county prosecutor, Scott Cafina, in Burlington County, talking about Caitlin McClure, her boyfriend, Mark D'Amico, and the homeless veteran, Johnny Bobbitt, who was involved in this as well. And it was all fake.
The paying it forward story that drove this fundraiser might seem too good to be true. Unfortunately, it was. The entire campaign was predicated on a lie. Less than an hour after their GoFundMe page went live, McClure, in a text exchange with a friend, stated that the story about Bobbitt assisting her was fake. D'Amico, McClure, and Bobbitt conspired to pass off a fake, feel-good story that would compel donors to contribute to their cause. And it worked, in a very big way, but it was fictitious and illegal, and there are consequences. My office has charged Mark D'Amico, Caitlin McClure, and Johnny Bobbitt Jr. with second-degree theft by deception and conspiracy to commit theft by deception. The trio's international media blitz to promote the fraudulent campaign convinced more than 14,000 donors to contribute a total of nearly $403,000 during last year's holiday season to help Johnny Bobbitt.
Wow. And it was all, as the president would say,
you are fake news.
Playback ready.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
And today's audio cut of the day is sponsored by the Good Feet Store. Pain relief and comfort to fit any budget. You know, every once in a while, I'll run across things, and for a certain age group, I think that they will not, like my producer's a good example, they will not remember folks like Roy Clark. I mean, when I was growing up, I watched Hee Haw with my grandparents all the time. I didn't really know much about it, except for there was a guy playing a banjo a lot, and they were trying to make me laugh.
So give me some beer, drink and music.
Well, Roy Clark is 84 years old and died today at his home in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He hosted I can't even believe this. Hee Haw was on for 24 years. 24 years. There you go. Roy Clark, dead at the age of 85. Much more coming up.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.